Advances in technology over the past decade or two have been amazing, rapid, and for many of us, terrifying.
It's probably more terrifying for the adults.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about a new book of terrifyingly awesome technology for students. We'll also talk about new training for ordering medical tests, learn how mental illness can lead to deportation, and spend an academic minute embracing students with disabilities. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Advances in technology can be amazing. They can also be pretty scary if you think they're moving too far or too fast. But that didn't stop Sean Connolly from having some fun with it, and that's just what he does in his new book for young students called The Book of Terrifyingly Awesome Technology, where he focuses on the T in STEM education. I spoke to Sean Connolly and asked him where this fun project got started.
Well, it's part of a longer project. It's part of a series which dates back about 10 years now. It's the seventh book in the series, but it really started out as a collaboration between me and my two youngest, who are twins, and that's when they were 9 years old. So it was a case of, well, they were entering the world of science with a little bit of trepidation, a lot of curiosity, a little bit of anxiety, and we thought the best way to help them out, and maybe I could learn a bit more, was to do some experiments with things we found around the house. So that triggered a series of chapters, if you like, which led to things about Boyle's Law and angular momentum and all sorts of things. And one thing led to another, and book after book came out based on that same sort of collaboration, if you like.
It's always been about science?
These have been. Well, in fact, to be more precise, they've evolved into STEM or STEAM books in as much as they've covered science, technology, engineering, and math. The T of STEM is the latest one, which is the technology book that's just out.
Boy, this would have been a very different book had you written it 9 years ago, because technology's advanced so much in those 9 years.
Well, exactly. And I think that maybe that's part of the whole notion of just getting in on the ground floor, but also being able to roll with the punches a bit, because I'm on a book tour right now. I talk to a lot of kids in all these school places, and I always have to say, hand on heart, I am not a scientist, but I'm always willing to learn to learn. And I hope that maybe they feel the same way, that they catch that bug.
How did you pick the topics that you were going to write about in the book?
Well, in both this book and the other ones, they can come either way. They can come with an idea, like I would love to learn a bit more about virtual reality or artificial intelligence, and then that leads to the, if you like, the meat and potatoes of each chapter. And then I would think of a spin-off experiment, which obviously we're not going to be creating virtual reality with nine-year-olds, but we can put them in mind of how something like that works by picking apart some of the aspects that lead to these complicated matters. So other times, an experiment kind of reveals itself, and I work backwards. I think, right, that's a cool thing. That's demonstrated, oh, perhaps driverless cars. And let's work back and then explain what driverless cars are. So it can work either way. Think of the topic, then the experiment, or experiment, then the topic.
And every one of your topics does have an experiment attached to it. Were you the test for these experiments?
Yes, by and large, either I or my children, who are a bit older than 9 years old now, but they helped out. I do tend to get willing volunteers. And, of course, the other thing I managed to do is that with each book I write, I just see how the experiments work on the road, if you like, because as I say, I go to dozens of schools, and I sort of think that one worked in this book. If I approach a similar topic in a later book, that's the good approach to use. So it's a nice way of getting the feedback. And, of course, as a writer, that's quite a solitary profession. Being able to get one-on-one contact with your readers is a great boon.
Well, you're on your tour, you're going to a school today. Do today's students understand just how much tech has advanced in the past 20 years?
It's hard to say. I mean, they quite often I have to assume that they might know as much or even more than I do about some of these things. But maybe the whole point is that I might have made more of an effort to understand what lies behind them. I suppose it's like any time when any generation grows up thinking that that's the norm, perhaps. And they don't necessarily look back to 78 records or, you know, reel-to-reel tape recorders. They just know what faces them in the here and now.
Are you finding that you call this book, of course, terrifyingly awesome? Is it terrifying more for adults or the young people?
That's a good question. You know, it's probably more terrifying for the adults. I mean, we've all had experiences with, you know, mothers or fathers who are struggling with their smartphone, or, you know, even in our household, our daughter Anna is the go-to person for any kind of IT problem. And I've, hand on heart, I've called out to say, Anna, why is everything in boldface or red? So perhaps it's the adults. And as you say, it's a kind of innocent confidence that the younger people have, which is perhaps a good thing.
You spotlighted artificial intelligence as kind of the crux of the book. Why is that?
Well, that seems to be the area, if you like, that's posing most, I wouldn't say problems, but if you were trying to find any of the topics I've written about, that's probably the one that strikes a nerve on the terrifying scale for lots of people. And it goes back even to, the first play written about robots. That was almost 100 years ago, and they take over from the humans. And I think it's this idea that, yes, we love smartphones. Yes, we love drones, maybe. But we don't think drones are going to take over the world or audio spotlights or many of the other things I've written about. Artificial intelligence has that capacity or that potential, and it's something that's philosophical, I suppose, as well as terrifying.
Well, it's the artificial intelligence that'll send the drones out to get us.
Yeah, well, that's true. It is true in the book that the artificial intelligence does feed into a lot of the different aspects of individual things, whether it's the Internet of Things or reusable rockets or microsatellites. If it's being programmed or chosen or dictated by something outside of immediate human input, then there comes the terrifying aspect.
And some of these big advances that you talk about are, they're not right now on the, you talk about test tube meat in the book, and you can go to Burger King and get an Impossible Burger now.
Well, that's true. It's funny because, the technology does sort of catch up with us sometimes and overtake. Many years ago, I wrote a book about experiments, and you had to use go and get a film canister. And, of course, who has film canisters anymore?
Right.
So, I have to keep an eye on what's going on around me as well.
One of the things you write about, and I've had the chance to actually witness this, is exoskeletons. And this, so much is being done with that right now.
Well, that's true. And, when I first heard the word exoskeleton as a kid, it was all to do with things like insects or beetles and things like that. And then you now realize that what we're really talking about is something that's a bit more like, older listeners will remember the $6 million man, that sort of thing, this kind of semi-android, semi-human quality. A lot of it is actually quite mundane, really, as opposed to overtly terrifying. If it allows someone at an assembly line at an automobile plant to keep his arms over his head for 6 hours, screwing things in, that's one use of this whole new technology.
I've actually seen, I've been to a VA hospital and seen disabled veterans get up and walk for the first time in some of these things. It's great.
Well, of course, that's absolutely inspiring, and it's a wonderful thing. And don't get me wrong, although the word terrifying does feature in all of these chapters, there's a big section in each case is how the world is a better place. So it's just saying, you know, think of any number of things, whether it was the first person who invented the bow and arrow probably thought it was a great way to feed a tribe. He never thought it would be a sort of a weapon of mass destruction in the Stone Age or something.
Well, that's actually where I wanted to leave this, is how is life better? Do the students that you speak to, are they more terrified, or are they more, look, this is making things better?
I think they take the optimistic view, and I suppose I'm an optimist as well. I like to let people know that there are these terrifying flip sides of the coin, but the children, and as I say, it's inspiring to go to school after school and see the enthusiasm that they have. I hope I'm not being naive by expecting or indeed hoping that they'll be able to use their knowledge and the sort of catching each wave of technological advance and moving it forward in a good way. So yes, I think they're upbeat about it, and that sort of assuages any fears I might have that linger.
And the only other question I'll ask, do students look at you and go, who's Barry White?
Yes, you're referring to one of my references to low-frequency sound. And to be honest, I do like to sneak in a few things, because these books aren't simply for kids. They're for kids and their parents or grandparents or older people in the family. So I like to feel that everyone gets a bit of a chuckle out of these things.
Again, the name of Sean Connolly's new book for young students is The Book of Terrifyingly Awesome Technology. Still to come, doctors are getting support, new training, and alerts to help cut down on orders for medical tests. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Too much inpatient hospital laboratory testing is a growing problem. Frequent and unnecessary testing causes patient discomfort, strains hospital resources, and increases healthcare costs. But a recent study appearing in the September issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry may have a practical solution. It's called Once Per Visit Alerts, a means to study alert compliance and reduce repeat laboratory testing. It looks at duplications of laboratory tests in the same hospital stay. The senior author of that paper is Dr. Ronald Jacobs, an associate professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. I asked him about one of the major topics of his paper, clinical decision support.
So clinical decision support, or CDS, is the use of information technology to improve the ability of healthcare providers to make beneficial decisions in a patient's care. The most commonly discussed format of CDS is the interruptive, or sometimes called pop-up alert, that appears in electronic ordering systems in response to a provider making a potential ordering error. But CDS really includes many more types of interventions that providers may not even realize are changing their behavior. For example, electronic order sets are designed to make it easier to place the desired orders and harder to place undesired orders. Similarly, patient results are displayed in the medical record in a way to highlight actionable information among a sea of less useful information. So all of these should be considered effective means of CDS in use today.
How can clinical decision support be used to improve lab test utilization?
So that's an important question, because I feel there's a lot of untapped potential for clinical decision support to affect lab test utilization. Lab medicine education is not highly emphasized in most medical school curricula. So physician ordering behaviors tend to be stagnant, despite an increasing body of literature showing that many lab tests are overutilized, underutilized, or incorrectly utilized. And this can lead to waste and even patient harm. Many institutions have implemented some simple CDS alerts to target low-hanging fruit, like the duplicate lab order, which is the alert that we reviewed in our study. But I think fewer hospitals take advantage of other effective interventions, like reflex test algorithms and order set design. This gap provides laboratorians an opportunity to demonstrate the value that our expertise has in improving patient care.
Why is it important to monitor CDS interventions, and what are the consequences of poorly implemented CDS?
That's a great question. It's very tempting to implement a CDS intervention and expect it to be successful, but on closer inspection, we often find that it didn't meet our expectations and sometimes had no useful effect at all. This can lead to two major negative outcomes. The first is what we call alert fatigue, in which providers who are assaulted by dozens of ineffective alerts every day eventually begin to ignore all alerts, even the useful ones, and resist the implementation of new CDS measures. The other negative outcome is what some people call de-skilling. Essentially, providers may simply submit to whatever recommendations are presented to them rather than apply their knowledge and experience in situations where the CDS tool may be giving bad advice. Unfortunately, healthcare systems may be willing to put in the resources to build CDS tools, but might not provide the means to study their effectiveness after implementation. I think we should view CDS as a cycle of continual improvement rather than a series of one-off fixes to specific problems. And that's why we felt it was important to review the way providers reacted to our duplicate test order alert.
Well, on that note, I noticed that provider compliance with your alert was highest on day 4 rather than day 1. Can you explain that?
Yeah, that was an unexpected finding of our study, but I think it provides important insight in the way providers interacted with the alert. It makes sense that compliance would decrease over time. A patient's health status may change over the course of an inpatient admission, inducing their physician to repeat previously ordered tests and look for a cause of that change. This isn't always a defensible practice, particularly for orders like hemoglobin A1C that we know are stable over the course of a few months. However, it might make sense for a test like ferritin when a rare diagnosis like macrophage activation syndrome is suspected. However, what we didn't expect was that peak compliance with the alert didn't occur on day 1. Sometimes providers bypassed the alert on tests that were ordered only within a couple hours or even minutes of a previous duplicate test. We think this may reflect perhaps the flurry of activity that occurs in the first hours of an admission, or it may be due to providers who order tests before the previous test has been completed and reported. That's a question that we plan to investigate further.
Well, finally, Doctor, did compliance with your alert differ by the ordering provider's role?
Yes, it did, and by a considerable amount, in fact. We were surprised to learn that registered nurses directly order a significant volume of lab tests at our institution, and they had the lowest compliance with our alert. They triggered about 22% of the alerts that we studied and had 23% compliance. This is in contrast to physicians and nurse practitioners who had a compliance of close to more than 60%. Since registered nurses are only allowed to order tests under the direction of a physician, we felt what was likely happening was that the nurses felt compelled to ignore the alert and continue ordering the test, even if it could have been inappropriate, rather than question the physician's decision. This highlights an important principle of CDS, which is to ensure that your intervention targets the providers who are truly responsible for the decision in order to maximize effectiveness. This means we need to go back and find a way to provide feedback to a patient's attending physician when nurses and residents bypass the alert on their patients, or alternatively, to empower nurses to check with the physician before bypassing an alert. Again, this is an example where monitoring the success rate of a CDS intervention can inform future improvements in our design.
Is this something that is now being taught in medical schools? Are people getting training, nurses, practitioners, and doctors on this?
I think it's still an area that needs a lot more education, but I know certainly medical schools have taken an interest in the overall field that we call clinical informatics. Clinical informatics includes a few areas of interest that look at ways to harness information technology to improve patient outcomes, and one of those is clinical decision support. I can even say at our institution, we are in a process of changing our curriculum to implement more of those more upcoming disciplines that really have a potential to improve population health and patient care in particular.
Dr. Ronald Jacobs is an associate professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. His paper appeared in the September issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Undocumented students face many barriers to getting help for mental illness, and without treatment, they may act out and get in trouble with the law. That can have serious consequences, including deportation. From Side Effects Public Media, Christine Herman has this story about one father who fears for his son's future.
Jose and his wife left Mexico and moved to the U.S. with their young children nearly two decades ago.
Fue por una mejor manera de vivir para mis hijos.
I came to give my kids a better life. In Mexico, it's hard to make enough to survive.
Jose is his middle name. He asks that we protect his identity since he's undocumented, as is his now 21-year-old son, who got diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder last year. Around that time, Jose says his son started acting aggressively and talked about hearing voices.
He asked us for help, but we didn't know how to help him. He'd say, "Dad, I feel like I'm going crazy."
Jose's son spent weeks in an inpatient psychiatric unit last year. Once, he began driving erratically, saying his car was telling him what to do. The next month, he talked about wanting to die and started walking in the middle of a busy street. But Jose says those hospitalizations didn't seem to make a difference, and at the time, his son didn't want more help.
He's totally lost. He says no, that he doesn't need help, but he doesn't realize the problem he has.
Jose's son agreed to talk to me, but didn't want to be recorded. He told me that last year he did meet with a therapist a few times and was taking medication he was prescribed in the hospital. He says medication helped, but without insurance, he couldn't afford $180 a month for the prescription. Back off meds, he struggled. That's a common problem for undocumented immigrants, says Carrie Chapman of the Legal Counsel for Health Justice in Chicago.
And it's just excruciating for families and for advocates. It's an incredible crisis that a vulnerable young person with serious mental illness falls through the cracks.
While undocumented children in Illinois and five other states can receive health insurance through Medicaid, they lose coverage at age 19. Chapman says that's right around when many people, like Jose's son, experience their first episode of psychosis. Andrea Kovach is a healthcare attorney at the Shriver National Center on Poverty Law in Chicago. She says 4 million adults living in the U.S. without legal status are uninsured and ineligible for Medicaid or insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And without treatment, their lives can spiral out of control.
Time and time again, too many young adults have entered the criminal justice system for the exact reason that there just aren't mental health services ready to help them.
That's what happened to Jose's son. Police were called after several violent outbursts at their home in Illinois. During the most recent incident in January, Jose's son was arrested after he broke a window and got into a fight with his brother-in-law. For an undocumented immigrant, criminal charges could mean deportation. At a court hearing in May, the judge gave Jose's son a warning.
If you are not a U.S. citizen, you are hereby advised that conviction of the offense for which you have been charged may have the consequences of deportation, exclusion from admission to the United States, or denial of that.
Jose's son pleaded guilty to several charges, including damage to property. He was sentenced to probation for 18 months, so as long as he stays out of trouble, he can stay out of jail. But his criminal record makes him a target for immigration officials. Jose worries about that, even though his son is back on medication and seems to be doing better.
Si llega él a ser deportado, prácticamente él va a estar perdido en México porque él no conoce México. Me lo traje muy pequeño.
If he gets deported, he'll practically be lost in Mexico because he doesn't know Mexico. I brought him here very young, and with his illness, where is he going to go? They're essentially putting him on the street.
Advocates say the only long-term solutions include expanding Medicaid to cover everyone regardless of legal status and creating a pathway to citizenship for people like Jose's son. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
A student with a disability doesn't automatically equal a student with a disadvantage. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Should we embrace the concept of disability as a positive component of student diversity? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Catherine Aquino, faculty member in the School of Continuing and Professional Studies at Manhattan College, looks into this question.
Individuals with disabilities constitute the largest minority group within the United States, and approximately one in every 10 students enrolled in higher education self-identify as having a disability. Although approximately 2.5 million students participate within the college environment, there continues to be a misperception that student disability is an impairment rather than a part of student diversity within the higher education environment. As members of the post-secondary community, it is our mission to support all student groups. However, do we address the student group solely as needs-based, or do we embrace the concept of disability as a positive component of student diversity? As faculty members and administrators, it is vital to ask, do we truly understand the diversity of and within the concept of disability in higher education? Driven by these questions, it was vital to explore the role of student disability in the college environment. Using longitudinal data of first-time students enrolling in the four-year post-secondary environment, my research revealed that, in addition to traditionally defined components of student diversity, including race, gender, and socioeconomic status, disability had predictive influence on students' perceived academic and social integration tendencies within the four-year institutional environment. Moreover, disabilities categorized as non-apparent, including learning disabilities and mental health categories, had a negative influence on students with disabilities' perceived social integration opportunities in higher ed. This research supports the argument that disability contributes to students' socio-academic integration and that because disability had a similar predictive influence as traditional components of student diversity, there is a strong justification to include disability in the broader understanding of student diversity in higher education.
That was Catherine Aquino of Manhattan College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.